You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money you spend. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Joseph G. Burke. Joe has spoken on archetypal patterns and business strategy in over 100 forums, including speeches at Boeing, USC Marshall School of Business, and the NG Customer Experience Summit. Joe created a startup digital agency at the age of 21 and served as a marketing executive at Disney and Goodwill, two of Forbes' 25 most inspiring companies in America. He currently owns Creative Business Strategy Agency, an award-winning toy company that he started with his children, and collaborates on a portfolio of projects, including producing and developing films. He has a new book. It's called The Anatomy of Yes. Joe Burke, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be here.
In chapter one, you start with a question, quote, "Have you ever wondered why a parent dies in a Disney movie, often within the first 15 minutes?" End quote. Yes, I have wondered that. Tell us why.
Well, there's many reasons that have been put out there for this. If you kind of go and Google things or look through Wikipedia, you'll hear a whole bunch of different explanations. One of them I find pretty fascinating and true. Walt and Roy Disney, when they were running Disney Studios, wanted to build a home for their parents. And so they did, but they used some of the contractors and carpenters that were building the movie sets. Hmm. Well, when you do that, things don't get constructed correctly, and there was a furnace in the house that caught fire, and it filled the house with smoke, and unfortunately their mother, Flora, died. Day. And so the story goes, and the legend goes, the reason that Disney films all kill a parent in the first 15 minutes is because it was sort of a way to cope with the death of their own parent. Completely untrue.
Okay.
Because if you look at completely debunked and untrue. Because if you, and I detail in the book all the reasons why, but, you know, I can simply state it this way. These stories are all retellings. You know, when they did Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, when they did Pinocchio, all these stories are missing a parent, or a parent dies. If you look at Finding Nemo, in the first 5 minutes, mom dies. If you look at Lion King, in the first 15 minutes, dad dies. If you look at Bambi. So all of these stories kill off a parent early on, but the real reason is these are retellings of old stories. Mm-hmm. And to cut to the chase a little bit, and when we talk about the anatomy of yes and the story behind every sale, to get to a sale, to really understand customers for life, you have to understand the construct of stories. There is a reason that Disney kills off parents in the first 15 minutes, and it has to do with archetypal patterns that exist in stories. And these stories are hardwired into our DNA. We are attracted to stories, music, the patterns of films, for very specific reasons, and they date back to early man. So that's an opener on the and sort of where this path started.
Yeah, and I was thinking about, you know, we've done this podcast for a few years now. We've talked to all different kinds of people. We've talked to storytellers, and we've talked about the idea of story, and I work in theater, so of course that's important to me. But I realized we haven't really touched on Joseph Campbell, which is shocking to me because Campbell's work is essential to understanding the sort of classic stories that have come from millennia, and he was someone who sort of defined it in more recent terms. But talk to us a little bit about, because you're obviously a fan and you recognize Campbell's work, but what is so powerful in this idea around the hero's journey?
the hero's journey, and I'll best explain it this way. Imagine a children's story like Hansel and Gretel with Big Bad Wolf with parents coming along for the ride. Imagine if the parents were present for these childhood adventures. Imagine Harry Potter if the parents, you know, which were non-existent in Harry Potter's life, but imagine his parents all of a sudden went to Hogwarts with him. What happens is these stories exist because children need to adventure on their own without parents. This is why a parent dies. Now, how did this come about? It goes back to very early man. In tribal mentality, what would happen is the parents and the elders would go out and they would hunt for food all day. And then at night, and if you recall this camping as a kid, you'd sit around a campfire and you would tell ghost stories or scary stories. The campfire is where all these stories start. And this is something that Campbell talked about quite extensively. What would happen is parents go out hunting. Parents don't know if they're going to come home or not. So the parents would come home, they'd gather around the campfire, and they would tell stories to kids about heroes. Hmm. Heroes and warriors and people that overcame great odds, people that killed the giant bear, people that, when they looked into the constellations, saw these great warriors of their past. And what they were doing is telling their children, we may not come home tomorrow. We may not survive, and you need to know how to survive without us, and you need to follow the legends of these warriors and survivors before you as an instruction manual as to how to survive without us. This is the root. This is how the systemic root of all storytelling was survival. And the two basic components of all storytelling are fear and enlightenment. Hmm. Because the hero always has to overcome fear to gain enlightenment. And this is exactly what the elders and the parents were telling children around the campfire in the early stages of man.
And I think it's interesting in Campbell's work where he talks about how many of these heroes are doing so, they're following these quests reluctantly, right? It's that they've sort of accidentally stumbled upon this, which also presents a kind of truism for young people that, you know, the stuff's not ordained, it's just, it's going to happen to you. And you know, it's about your mindset when it happens as opposed to, you know, a fated thing.
You're absolutely right. In fact, there's an illustration in the book that talks about the 12 stages of this. In Celtic literature, they call it the Emron, and other people call it the soul journey. And just as you stated, the first step in that journey is when you are living in a natural world, life as you know it, and all of a sudden a crisis or a challenge is placed in front of you. The first thing you do is a refusal to the call. And it's human nature, and it's also what the elders were telling the young kids around the campfire. When this happens, when you take on this challenge, when you're faced with a dragon or a bridge or a chasm to overcome, the first reaction you will have is a reluctance to take on that call.
Yeah, that's the no, right? I mean, so in our work in improvisation, we recognize that people's default behavior is to do nothing or say no. And so the whole idea around yes and is to sort of force yourself to say the words that you it doesn't matter if you believe it or not, but saying the words will move you into this place where you can eventually sort of, you know, accept this call and start to co-create. And when you talk about, you know, the sort of story idea, really it's a three-act thing, right? We're sort of hardwired that way.
That's correct. The crisis, conflict, and resolution. Every story, every TV commercial, every song, every, you know, good storytelling song will always go through that same exact trajectory. Crisis, all of a sudden, the hero, the customer is always the hero, by the way, in sales. Mm-hmm. And you always have to look at the customer on a hero's journey. So posing a crisis to the customer is probably one of the best things to do in a sale because it will show the conflict, which is why this crisis exists and other people that are trying to solve this crisis that can't. And then the resolution is how we as a product or a service are going to solve this problem better than anybody else.
And one of the things I was enjoying about this too is I've been increasingly coming to the realization that the idea that there is a business life and a home life, like these are sort of I don't know. They're walls that we put up and constructs that we create that are really of the mind, because this is all about actually how humans communicate, how they think, how they make decisions. So, you know, when you ask, well, why would you apply the storytelling work into business? It's because that's the way that people hear and they purchase and they make decisions through emotion.
You're spot on. And if you look at the qualitative and the quantitative side of emotion, you find that in the human brain, it's detailed with the cited citations and research in the book, but the human mind, where it's making really the prefrontal cortex, where we make our decisions, it's going to be occupied by one of three different chemicals. You're going to have dopamine and serotonin, which is enlightenment, and you're going to have... I really should read my own book. cortisol. So cortisol is a chemical of fear, and serotonin and dopamine are chemicals of enlightenment. They compete for the same space in the brain. They don't live in two different areas of the brain. So to your point, the human mind is constantly in conflict, and it's constantly looking to overcome crisis, which is fear, which is cortisol. It is a chemical, and you will find dopamine and serotonin will take over. And in fact, just to compound that, you know, if you look, it's on page 39. I'm looking at this, you know, the MROM. To your point with the refusal, the thing that will get you across the first threshold, and this is in classic storytelling and in life, is a mentor. And as we look to either read books, as we look to read interviews, as people that we know, we are constantly looking for mentors, because we know that every challenge we have will have a refusal. And what will get us across that first threshold in tackling or overcoming a crisis is to reach out to a mentor. It could be someone we know, and it could be someone we don't know.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things, and this is more now commonly debunked, is that when Malcolm Gladwell talked about those 10,000 hours, what he missed is this idea inside deliberate practice is that you also have a mentor, that you're sort of being guided. And we know this by performance in any arena. We know it from sports, and we know it from theater, and we know it from you. I mean, you have these coaches, you have these mentors who can help you kind of discover who you are in the world. And that's the key too. It's not making you be some, you know, thing that's other than you. It's the best you can be.
You're spot on. And, you know, if you follow that path, once you find that mentor and you cross that first threshold, you will be immediately met with enemies, allies, and tests. You will have people that are against you on this journey. There are people that will be your ally and are going to help you. And you will also be tested. And again, this is life, but this is also, you think about Tolkien and his stories. And if you think about, you know, The Hobbit and, you know, Lord of the Rings, this is the same. This is why these stories, Star Wars, are so popular, is because that tuning fork that they're hitting is so primal to our being and our survival and our prosperity that they're truly tapping a primary tuning fork that magnetizes us to these stories. And especially with visual movies, we're truly sitting around a campfire once again in the dark, listening to our elders.
I want to talk about a couple of the archetypes, and the first one that you cite is the quest for identity. And I found it really interesting. You have a stat in there that says 36% of millennials have tattoos. And this is about symbols, right? And this is about, and then that, of course, would include logos if you're talking about a company. So unpack for us a little bit about how this sort of quest for identity plays across our personal into our business.
Great question. The quest for identity starts young. It starts young in an organization, and it starts young in our lives. When we're children, and we've got three children of our own, so we're living through this again, but when we were children, we would put on masks and capes and take on voices and roles because we were on our own quest for identity. We either tried out music, athletics, mathematics, and we were trying to find instinctually what we were good at, but also what our identity was at a very young age. In organization, companies do the same exact thing. At a very early stage of a company, one of the first things they do is come up with a name for a company before it's even anything. Then they come up with a logo for the company before it's even anything. Why? Because other people do it? Maybe. But why does everybody do it, and why are these logos and symbols so powerful? Because a symbol, a logo. And if I just say certain logos, if I say swoosh, you just had a, your mind lit up
yeah.
in certain ways. If I say Starbucks, you smell something. Mm-hmm. If you see that logo, you have a physiological reaction to that. Because what that symbol is a representation of a reputation. That symbol represents an experience that has been compounded. And organizations and companies, many of which I coach in this arena, I preach the same exact tactic, the same exact philosophy, is that if you want to be great at something, if you truly want to have a brand, you have to do something extremely repeatable, extremely consistent, and it has to be married with what I call a visual hammer, which is a logo, and a mantra, which is a slogan, which some people call. And I constantly preach this, to do this over and over again. So in the quest for identity, which starts out very early in an organization and very early in our own personal lives, it's important to discover what we are repeatedly and consistently good at, because that will lay the foundation of our identity as a person and as an organization. And these things that we do very early on in organizations and very early on in our lives live, the way that we gain acceptance as kids doesn't change much for the rest of our lives.
Yeah. As you were talking about that, instantly this visual came into my mind, and I didn't think this, it's not in my notes, I didn't write down when I was reading the book, but I'm like, oh, this is like the pussy hats and the MAGA hats, right? I mean, it is this symbol that people are wearing to, you know, signal their tribe, and they're so triggering for the opposite, I imagine, on both ends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, let me give you an example, since, you know, I find politicians fascinating. There's a chapter in the book called Build a Wall with Hope and Change Because It's the Economy, Stupid.
Right.
You know, and it's and I always look at these things objectively. I mean, my job as a marketer is to look at every brand and service and experience objectively from the outside in. And so if in April of 2016, I was speaking to a university group here in California, and there was a reporter in the crowd. And I said, look, I'm not making value judgments on political candidates. In fact, the only political candidate I would have ever got behind is Abraham Lincoln, because he's from Illinois and a wrestler like me. So I said, I don't care what you think of the guy, but I'm telling you, and it was April of 2016, mm-hmm. I said, Donald Trump's going to win the presidential election. Mm-hmm. And I got, you know, a handful of jeers and hisses. You know, and it was a reporter who actually wrote an article about this the following week. And I said, again, I'm not making a value judgment, but I'm telling you, I know what he's doing. I predicted the same thing with Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama had hope and change. He said it over and over again. Hope and change, hope and change, hope and change. Had that Harper Ferry picture of him yeah. in the red. Very iconic. And he did it, and I was watching it. I'm like, he's going to win. He understands the fundamentals of storytelling. Donald Trump's and his team did the same exact thing. They used these very simple phrases where the first word is an action verb, and they said it over and over and over again. And they used visual hammers. And look, Donald Trump, I remember watching him on The Apprentice, and I knew it back then. The guy understands marketing, because he always wears a red tie, always got the gold hair. Mm-hmm. These are very intentional moves. Winston Churchill did the same thing. So many different figures, public figures in our past, can be associated with certain visual hammers in ways they are logos into themselves. So yeah. So that's your point is well taken, because those hats, again, they represent something that's repeatable and consistent, that there's a cohort behind.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and brands have figured this out, right? That you can no longer afford to sit on the sideline. And so Nike, you know, was like, nope, we know who our core audience is. And so they're going to go out and be all cool about Colin Kaepernick and know that they're turning off a big part of the country. But, you know, their sales are, they're speaking to their tribe when they do that.
Well, what was it? Oscar Wilde said, the only thing worse than being talked about is being ignored.
Right.
Yes. So and I watch these things play out, and it's funny because I'm in the business of doing this. I do this for companies. I've done crisis management for companies. I've done a lot of message architecture for companies. I mean, guys like you and I mean, we can see this stuff come in 5 miles away.
Right.
I mean, you could see the Betsy Ross shoes. Maybe I can be proven wrong, but I'm certain it was never an intention that those were going to hit the store shelves.
Right.
You know, many of these things are done because if you really understand advertising, and this is a bit of blasphemy that a lot of my friends in the past would maybe slap me on the wrist for, but brands are not built on advertising. Brands are built on publicity. Mm. They're only supported by advertising. If you look at the smartest brands, they build their brands on publicity. Look at what Nike does. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many ads do they really have to run? No, the media and all this earned media, we ran it for them. All the lines in front of a store to get an iPhone, the new iPhone, all the lines in front of the store to get the latest Nike sneaker. This is all, it cost them nothing. And this is, and I will tell you, I mean, and I, again, my advertising buddies would probably, you know, kick me under the table for this one. But when I go into a company, the first thing I do is journey map and figure out what we can do and accomplish without spending a dime.
Sure.
And you will find the best ideas, because most people are lazy when they have big budgets. I know it. I worked at very big companies. We had very big budgets and we made bad decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I was running things at Second City, and this is on a very local level, but you know, you're from here. When Rod Blagojevich, our former governor, was going through his issues, like I produced a show called Rod Blagojevich Superstar on a shoestring budget, because I just knew, you know, that we just had to say those words with Second City, and suddenly we sold out the entire run before the first show even went up. Then we ran this thing for like a year and we moved it to larger locations. And I was like, this is the thing. And then we got him to do the show one night for a donation, which was actually going into his pocket. But it was like, so the amount of media we got in that year for this little like thing was astronomical. We were on Good Morning America and it cost us basically nothing.
Yeah. I mean, how many Facebook ads did you have to run? How many TV spots did you have to run? How
Zero.
Many digital radio ads did
Zero.
You have to run on Pandora? Zilch.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that and Hamilton's that way, right? I mean, like when you have a certain kind of product that is out there in the place, and they maybe do some advertising, but they really don't need to.
No, I mean, even the thing where they, I think it was something where the vice president was at one and they did a speech. You know, it was interesting. It brought me back a little bit to Shakespeare. I think it was in Hamlet, one of the plays, the thing that will catch the conscience of the king.
Yes.
So it was interesting. But again, episodes like that will create a groundswell. And, you know, we call it scientifically a viral coefficient, because you can measure these things. And we constantly look at viral coefficients and network effects. But they're created by I would say 99 times out of 100, something that costs very little.
Yeah, yeah. All right, there's another archetype I want to talk about, and it's the restoration of the wasteland. And this is very interesting, because in this chapter you talk about your experience at Goodwill Industries. And I want you to talk to a bit about our audience about that and how that represents this restoration of the wasteland.
Yes, there is a chronology to these archetypes, and you will always find a restoration of the wasteland after you have, you know, let me just go through these quickly.
Yeah.
You'll go through a dragon and treasure phase of your life. It starts at adolescence, where you will slay dragons to get treasures. This could be in forms of music, you know, musical competitions, sports, academics. You slay dragons and get treasures. And then every one of us has had at least 5 to 20 to 50 descents into the underworld. And a descent into the underworld is a health issue, a family, a death in the family, a personal crisis. And the deeper you go into these descents, the more powerful you emerge. Now, going through that, slaying dragons in our adolescence, finding ourselves in battle through our teens and through our early 20s, we will find ourselves in multiple descents into the underworld, and we will find ourselves restoring wastelands. Why do we do this? Because what happens is we get to a point in our lives where we've had so many descents into the underworld that we look around the world and unselfishly want to fix things. Mm. We want to fix people. And it's a natural archetypal chronology that every human being will go through. Now, when I was at Goodwill Industries, I reluctantly, again, I refused the call. My wife now is a professor in the Department of Special Education at a local university, and her whole career, though, was in special needs. She worked with kids in East Los Angeles and some of the toughest parts of the country, and with kids with special needs, and some of which didn't even have a physical address. Hmm. So the restoration of the wasteland comes when, you want to fix people. Goodwill, I knew a board member, and I helped out a little bit, and they said, hey, do you want to come over? And I said, well, I don't want to be selfish, but I don't think you can afford me. And they basically took two divisions, and I said, okay, let's do this. Goodwill Industries was started by a minister, Edgar Helms, in Boston. It was during the Depression. And what he saw was people being thrown into the streets because they had a disability. These people were thrown into the streets because they were either in a wheelchair or their hands didn't work or they had an illness. And then he saw on the other side of the alley things being thrown into the streets, an old dresser, an old chair. And it's genius. I mean, he was, this was the first American social enterprise. He looked and put those two things together. He says, I'm going to take people that the world considers and this society considers broken, and take things that people consider broken, and I'm going to fix them. And these so-called broken people are going to fix these so-called broken things. And he created Goodwill Industries, which today is a $5 billion organization in the U.S. And does many great things. And again, it's one of Forbes' top 25 most inspiring companies. And my work there was no different. It was, I had an amazing team. And the team that I had around me were as selfless as the founder. And it's interesting, the sort of the lower you went in the org chart, meaning the people at the service level, the more like they were as Edgar Helms. And maybe as you went up, the less like Edgar Helms they were. But it was fascinating work, and restoration of the wasteland is exactly that. It is fixing things in people. And we had the good fortune of winning an Addy Award for a song that we wrote in a radio ads that we wrote called Find the Good. And so I was working with the team one day, and they'd show up early and leave late, never had to ask them to. And I had two different divisions. And just, again, wonderful, wonderful people that were taking jobs for less salary than they would elsewhere. But we were working late one night. We were coming up with, we wanted a mantra. We had to have a mantra. We already had, you know, a visual hammer, which was the Goodwill smiley face, which is extremely iconic. And so we were throwing words around, like in a word soup, and all of a sudden the words appeared, find the good. So we came up with this mantra, find the good, and we started using it because the idea was find the good in people. But also when you go into a Goodwill store, you may find the good. Mm-hmm. People have gone into Goodwill, spent $10 on a painting, and sold them for $153,000 in an auction. These are true stories, and things like this happen quite often. So we wrote this, and I'll cap this story medium long, but we wrote this mantra, and we got connected with the Aquabats. You may not know them, but if you have kids, there's a TV, kids TV show called Yo Gabba Gabba on Nickelodeon. Yeah, so the Aquabats created Yo Gabba Gabba, and they so they took what we created. I said, listen, we need a song, we need a theme song. And I want to do radio spots, and I want like a theme song. So one of the guys in the Aquabats was running one morning, and it came to him in a flash, was find the good, and the good will find you. So a whole song was written around this whole idea, is find the good, and the good will find you. And it translated. What happened is we did run ads on Pandora, but we stuck this on our answering machines. Anywhere that we could get audio before events, at events, it became such a hook. It was played before the Angels games and on Angel games. And we ended up doing unbelievable numbers. And I can't say it was that one song, but it was a number of things like that. In 1 year's time, we did 8.66% growth over the previous year against a national average of 0.4%. And it was unheard of. No one believed it. They said, no, you mean, you know, 0.8%. I said, no, it's actually 8.66% and 4.6% comp stores for those, you know, versed in the technicalities of retail. Yeah. But it was unheard of, those numbers. And it was because of that attitude. And again, I can't credit the team enough. They were just amazing to work with.
You said something early in that story where you were talking about the various people at the organization, and sometimes the lower you go, you know, that's where you're discovering your real heroes. Another guest of ours had said, you know, the problem with leadership is when the leader's desk is the farthest away from the actual customer. And you write in the book, quote, the anatomy of yes can't be found sitting in your office chair. I think this is something I've discovered over time, which is, and there's a Harvard guest that we had on who talked about the need to be on the dance floor and in the balcony. You can't just stay in the balcony, and you can't just live on the dance floor, but too many leaders are doing one or the other.
Yeah, I'd agree. I'll tell you a real quick story because it relates to Chicago. We were at the New York Toy Fair in February of this year. We have a toy company, and one of our toys won Toy of the Year. Robert Payson, the Robert Payson, chief wagon officer of Radio Flyer, who's really the CEO, third generation owner, came down to meet us at Toy Fair and invited us to his factory, which incidentally my grandfather worked at, so in Chicago. And so we went there this past summer and we visited with Robert, and he took us for a tour around the office. And his office is right in the cubicle farm with everybody else, right on the edge. Mm. And again, it was affirmation of great leadership. Because again, just as you put it, he wasn't in the balcony. He was on the stage or the dance floor. And he was there as the chief wagon officer with great humility, but great respect. And again, a great example of an organization that's got it right.
Yeah, Robert will be coming on the podcast in the new year. He is on sabbatical right now, but we met at an event, and I was like, I mean, it's fascinating in terms of that company and their history, how it started here in Chicago. And I don't want to go into it because we'll talk about it with him, but really, really cool guy. All right, in a moment, I'm going to ask you for your yes and story, but there was one other quote from the book that I want you to elaborate on, because I kind of love it. You say in the book, quote, "Functionally delusional people are vital to the growth and success of your organization." Explain why that's the case.
Well, you know, since we're talking Chicago, let me bring it back to Phil Jackson.
Okay.
You know, Phil Jackson always had a disruptor. He had Dennis Rodman. He had Rick Fox. He always had someone on his team that was functionally delusional. And Rodman's one of the great examples, too, because he's got a great personal story of his own. Mm-hmm. I met him a couple times. He wouldn't remember me. But he is one of those functionally delusional. He does things that no one else would take the risk of doing, and all of a sudden inspires us to do great things. And I think Phil Jackson knew this well. And if you look at the people that have led industries, if you look at, I talk about Helen Keller, I talk about Jackie Joyner Kersee. I mean, this is a girl who almost died at the age of 18 because of asthma. She had no business being the most decorated women's Olympian in history. No business. Mm-hmm. At 18, she should have quit. That, you know, to your point, that was her no.
Yeah.
But these functionally delusional people are like when we were kids. Remember when we were kids, there was that creek that was really fast running and really long, and they said, oh, you're not going to make it over the creek. You're not. And there was that one kid that just did it. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, a functionally delusional person who was delusional enough to actually do it, but functional enough to actually succeed at it. Because otherwise, if you're too delusional, it's one of these hold my beer and, you know, bad things happen.
Yeah.
But if you look for functionally delusional people in an organization, and they exist in every organization, and many of them are told to not talk. Many of them are told to, you know, that people manage around them. I embrace them and always have. And I could name every single place that I've been where there was a functionally delusional person that I said, let's listen to this. This is a disruptor. This is somebody who's going to do something that is thinking in a diagonal pattern when we're all thinking linear, and we will learn from them.
Well, you can imagine that I worked with many of those people in my 31 years at Second City. It is a prerequisite that a cast member is functionally delusional.
It's a fun. And I think it's, and again, this is what we love about performers, comedians, because they take us to a place that we kind of think of, and we would never actually do that. But when they do that, it's almost like, I love the Socrates quote, artists lie to tell the truth. They have to sort of over-exaggerate and use hyperbole to really expose the truth of what something is. And I think we see this over and over in comedy. And I'm a huge fan of Will Ferrell, by the way.
Yep.
I think he does this expertly well, and I think I go into examples in the book with Evel Knievel and some other people, but functionally delusional people are ones to take very close note of, and I wouldn't use the word encourage, but to cultivate their thought patterns.
I'll tell you a quick Will Ferrell story, who's not Second City, but my friend Adam McKay, who was his partner in Funny or Die and did Anchorman and all those other films with him. They started at Saturday Night Live the same year. Adam was on the writing staff and Will was in the cast. Will, for the first week, every season of Saturday Night Live that he was there, would play a different character for that full week and wouldn't drop the character. So he'd call himself Ron, or he'd call himself something else, and he'd have all these affectations, never dropped it. And so it was like, and I remember Adam coming back, he's like, this guy is out of his mind, and I love him. And certainly you can see the work since then is, you know, genius.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great story.
Yeah. All right. So I'm wondering, and I'm sure you have it, a yes and story, a time in your life when you normally would have said no, but you didn't just stop at yes, you said yes and.
Yes, and.
Good.
This happened twice, yes. It happened twice, and they were very interconnected. I'll paint the picture. I'm in front of the Kodak Theater on Hollywood Boulevard. I was living in Santa Monica at the time. And my wife was, we were going to the Jimmy Kimmel show. We knew the producers. We'd go to the green room thing. And so my wife was, I was meeting her there. And she was on the other side of the street, and she was waving. And she said, anyway, she tells me to come over to the other side of the street. I'm like, no, Al Capitan Theater. This is where we're going. She said, no. So I run over right in front of the Kodak Theater where they do the Oscars. Mm-hmm. And she says, we are having our first child. Huh. And I was, of course, yes, all with that.
Yeah.
But at the time, I had my own ad agency, but I was also an actor. Mm-hmm. I had performed in 25 TV shows and films. I had just came out of a lead in an independent film, and the producers were writing another film for me. I had come, you know, within 5 yards of being Cyclops in the X-Men. Mm. And my career was going in a path where it looked like, you know, this is what I was going to be doing. In that moment, I knew in front of the Kodak Theater, I would never walk the stage. I would never do it again. And I knew that that my life was going to change and that I had different priorities now. Mm. Now, that tied into almost exactly 10 years later. 10 years later, we found ourselves in New York City, and this is our past February. We had started a toy company while, again, servicing other clients with my other company, and I started a toy company on my kitchen table, and my kids wanted to play ball in the house, and it was too hot outside, so I kind of went into this quest, or obsession, it really was, to create a ball that you can play with indoors. So over 100 iterations turned into a trademark, turned into a patent, turned into an international patent, and we were awarded at the Oscars of the toy industry in New York City, Toy of the Year. And the no in the no was, my career was in at a time when my wife told us about her first child that I know that part of my life was ending. And that was by choice. I mean, normally I would have said, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I love doing. I got to travel the world to do movies. I love doing TV shows. I mean, it was just, it was so much fun. And I said, you know, this now changes. And then when the toy company was in its growth, I mean, I think I was 50, 60, 70 grand into it with patents and everything. Mm. And, you know, people are going, what are you doing? You invented a ball that doesn't bounce. And I said, yeah, but I think there's something to it. And we ended up doing something at Indiegogo. You know, you put these ideas and you launch them on Indiegogo, and yep, you try to get people to buy something before it's available. I had one sale. Hmm. And just to get that Indiegogo, I had had these three professional soccer players at the house. We filmed this big video. We did all the social media. I probably spent another 25 grand. And at that point, you know, everyone kind of looked at me and kind of backed away like Homer Simpson into like some hedges. And so I said, you know, the no there was where I've normally said no. It's like, look, I'm already burned about 100 grand on this thing with my own money, and it's probably time to just, you know, fold up the lawn chair and head home. But normally that would be the rational thing to do, but of course I didn't. I listened to my own advice and was delusional and kept at it, kept spending money on it, kept exploring it, kept building it. And today that we have toys in 7 countries and major retailers all over the U.S. And we're about to go into 7 more major retailers in the U.S. in the spring of 2020. So those two come together because I remember, you know, saying to my wife, you know, it's really, especially in my mind, this is so exciting. We're having a child, but like that part of my life is over. I'm not going to win an Oscar. And then when we were in New York City in Manhattan getting that award, I gave her a big hug on stage. And I'm like, look, we ended up getting an Oscar anyway at the toy industry. So it was kind of a neat full circle, and two times where I thought I knew what I was doing. I thought I had a definite plan, but you know, like a meteor come hits you in the middle of space and sends you on a different trajectory.
I love it. The book is called The Anatomy of Yes. Joe Burke, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.